I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Before we jump into the heart of our program with Elizabeth Barbush and Donald Gresham about the Save Middle East Action Committee and what's going on the east side of Baltimore, and a really fascinating project that they put together with Voices. You'll hear some great tape about that, about a struggle going on to save one of our neighborhoods in the city. We're going to first talk to Sam Brand, who is assistant coach here at Morgan State University's basketball team. He was a standout here in the Morgan State University team when he played here. And I'll have to make a confession here. I've known Sam Brand since he was in diapers, and he is tantamount to my nephew. So that's not why he's here, because he's doing a good job of the program he's working on. Sam, good to see you.
Very nice to see you, Mark.
Yeah, can you imagine yourself in diapers?
It's been a while.
But it's good to see you, man.
So always.
So, Sam, you're now assistant coach here in your second season, right?
Third
season.
Yes.
And you've taken it on your own to create your own summer basketball camp. Talk about what's going on.
Yes, well, Coach Bozeman told me that, you know, he wanted me to try to start out a basketball camp here at Morgan. And the previous attempts have been unsuccessful. It's just a place where sometimes it's hard to get kids from Baltimore City and get their parents. And transportation is a problem. And obviously money is a problem sometimes. And in the past, there hasn't been much interest in getting a camp here at Morgan. But we had a great year this year. And it's something that, you know, I got when I went to school here at Morgan, I got my degree in mathematics. And
getting your master's degree now in mathematics.
Yes, math education now. Right. And so I've always, you know, been very interested. I came up in Baltimore City Public Schools, grew up in various neighborhoods in Baltimore, and was really excited at the opportunity to be able to involve the community a little bit and kind of bridge the gap a little bit between Morgan and the city of Baltimore.
So what's going to happen to this camp? When's it start? How do kids get involved? What are you going to be doing?
The camp is June 22nd to the 26th. The hours of operation are 9 to 4:30. To get involved, you can go to www.morganstatebears.com, and you can register online and also view the camp flyer online. And all the information where the checks would be sent and all that good stuff is online.
Does it cost money to go to the camp?
Yes. The cost of the camp, if you register before June 1st, so if you go on either this weekend up until Monday, we are the camp is $175 with a $100 deposit due. And
is there scholarship help?
Yes, there is. What we've been doing, we actually started with a bake sale from some of our female managers and myself. Got together, did a bake sale. I've been going around getting some sponsorship. Downtown Locker Room helped us out a lot. We do have scholarships available. However, they are merit-based. We've been going, we visited about 20 different schools, middle schools and high schools in the area, and have been, you know, asking for one child who has interest in the game of basketball and also is doing what they need to do in the classroom and might not be able to afford the camp. So we do have some scholarship money available. We would, you know, it, like I said, it's merit based. So if you're doing well in school and you have some interest in the camp, contact us. You can call myself 443-829-8381 or go online, and my email address is on the flyer as well.
So how many weeks does this camp go on?
It's 1 week this year. The eventual goal of the camp is to have a completely sponsored camp and to be able to go around and find kids in the community who are interested in basketball, want to learn the game, and bring them all up to the campus free.
Who's teaching?
We have the entire Morgan coaching staff will be working the camp. Yes, we have some guys that are playing professional basketball overseas that are coming home for the summer that'll be working the camp. We'll have our team as counselors in the camp, and a lot of our guys are Baltimore guys, so you know they're excited about doing it as well. We're very excited about it. We've been working very hard to, like I said, we've raised money from a bake sale to sponsor kids, and And then we've also had some interest and just people coming to come to the camp. So it's been going very well, and we hope it continues to do so. And we invite all you out there listening. You got any kids with between ages of 9 and 17, boys and girls, want to come up, we're going to give everyone a tour of the campus. Everyone's going to fill out a Morgan application. It's also bigger than just a basketball camp because we're dealing with kids in the Baltimore community. I know I didn't step foot on a college campus except for Essex Community College. My father taught there.
Your father taught there.
Yes.
Right.
But yeah, just oftentimes our kids aren't exposed to college, and we got this great university here, and there's so many new things have been happening here even since I've been here. This is my eighth year at the school, and so we're gonna expose kids to basketball and do the same drills with them that we do with the team, and at the same time we're gonna get them a little bit involved in the college life as well, because it's, you know, that's very important to us. It's an important part of what we're doing at the camp as well.
Sam Brand, good luck with this camp. Assistant coach, Morgan State University basketball team, sponsoring a camp for 9 to 17-year-olds here on campus, starting June 22nd. And give the telephone number and the email of the website again.
It's www.morganstatebears.com, and you click on the men's basketball link, and you can sign up for the camp and view the camp flyer there. If there's any questions, I'm fully involved. This is my cell phone number, 443-829-8381. Call me for any interest or any questions you have about the camp.
Sam Brand, good luck.
Thank you.
It's going to work.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, come by and watch and see what you all are doing.
No doubt about it.
All right.
All right.
Good luck, man.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for being here. So, folks, you want your kids to play some ball, learn some ball from great players and great coaches, sign up for this camp this summer at Morgan State University and let your kids be off the street and doing something really good for themselves and for this community. We're going to take a short break and come right back and take a trip to East Baltimore. So stay with us for that. Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. Over 7 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. For the rest of this hour, we're going to be talking about a couple of things, but focused around the neighborhood in East Baltimore known as Middle East that has been fighting for its survival in the wake of the expansion of the biotech park at Johns Hopkins Hospital. We've had a number of shows about this over the years. We're not here today to kind of just fight that battle and talk about Hopkins. They've always been invited to the show. We've had these shows before. This is because Art on Purpose has spent over a year taking photographs and compiling interviews that are made into a book entitled Middle East Baltimore Stories, Images and Words from a Displaced Community. It's a partnership between Art on Purpose and the Save Middle East Action Committee. It was funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. The woman who was program director for that at Art on Purpose and who collected a lot of these stories and edited them into what some of the stories you're going to hear today is Elizabeth Barbush, who's in the studio with us. Elizabeth, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on the show. And Donald Gresham is with us, who's been on the show before, and he's president of the Save Middle East Action Committee. And Donald, welcome back. It's good to have you
Thank
here,
you.
Too.
Welcome. Good to be here.
And you all can see these photographs and hear more of this audio that we're going to be playing this hour at the book launch that will happen this Saturday at the Reginald Lewis Museum downtown from 2 to 6 p.m. You can visit artonpurpose.org, one word, artonpurpose.org, or our website to link to that to find out more information. We'll be talking about during the course of the hour. And so, again, both of you, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And the lines are open at 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation. Let's talk a bit about this, how this all came about. I mean, I think that one of the really very interesting things about Art on Purpose and the work that you all do there is that you have Peter Bruin, who founded Art on Purpose. I've known him for a while. He was an OSI fellow when he created this. The idea that art is a community tool and a tool for social action and social change, that you involve people in our communities in a very active way with the arts. And I think that and using art as a tool to express people's lives. This is a fairly unique thing, I think, in the kind of the expansiveness as that we're doing it here in Baltimore, Art on Purpose. Talk a bit about that philosophically and this whole project, would you?
Well, what Art on Purpose does is uses art to bring people together around certain social justice issues. And we do that in a variety of ways. We hold art workshops. We put up exhibitions. And basically, the idea is to get at these issues in a new way and to get people interested in issues in a new way and to give a platform and a venue for people to express their stories, opinions, or ideas through art. And really, I think what it does is bring together a variety of audiences that may have not been brought together before.
Donald Gresham, to talk about, I mean, what got SMEAC, the Save Middle East Action Committee, to get involved in all this.
And the interesting part about it, you know, being partners with Art on Purpose was interesting because we started out with doing maps, just having people to take where they lived and how they saw in a map form. And that was initial beginning, and then much communication and continuing. Partnership with Art on Purpose. We thought about the stories of the community, especially those who were going to leave and those who were staying present. So it was really a great opportunity for us to get those stories while they were still here.
Well, let's play a piece of these things. What you've done, tell us what we did here. I'm just doing a radio show. But you, what you all did when you made this coalition with the Middle East Committee and created these Middle East Baltimore stories. Images and words from a displaced community, and what your approach was, and what these audio clips were about to hear, what they're from, what they form.
Well, the idea came from a project that we had started before called Speaking of Silence, and the goal of that project was to provide a platform for people who are not normally heard or traditionally silenced to be heard. And we held an exhibit, and director of SMEAC, Nathan Soy, came to see that exhibit and saw the way that we displayed photographs of individuals along with their words was a really powerful way of getting their voices heard. And so that's when the idea came upon us to partner to try to get the Middle East Baltimore stories told. So we started out with Nathan and Donald giving me a list of people's names to contact about who would want to share stories and what kind of stories. So I started with that. People were gracious enough to invite me into their homes. And I didn't really have a particular list of questions that I wanted to get answers to. It was really just to begin to see what it was important to share about the neighborhood and what was important to share about the experiences that had not been shared before and what people weren't hearing about this development project and what it was doing to individuals' lives and their community.
Let's hear one of these pieces. This is a cut from this project. We're talking about the Art on Purpose project, Middle East Baltimore Stories. And you can see it and hear it all in its entirety and buy the book that comes with this, get the book, whatever you do with it, at the book launch this Saturday at the Reginald Lewis Museum from 2 to 6 p.m. But this is the first clip is where residents are discussing the problems and mistrust caused by lack of communication from the East Baltimore Development Corporation, EBDI. So let's listen to this piece. We'll talk about this piece when we come back.
I think it was summer, mid-summer, when you heard rumors. I was hearing rumors at first, and then they started putting these papers out here. And then when I started going to the meetings, in my opinion, the meetings wasn't stemmed towards renters. They more or less wanted to get to their homeowners. It was like the renters were third-rated citizens to them. And the questions I would ask, they really wouldn't get answered. When I asked them questions about the church, I would get an answer like, well, we'll deal with y'all one-on-one. That's not an answer. To me, that was putting it aside. We're in the dark. All we know is that one day they're going to come to us and we're going to have to move.
We received a letter in the mail in reference to a big biotech center coming and that we would probably be moved. This lingered on from 2000, and actually this didn't happen till this year, which was 2008. So, I mean, you had people that were just dangling in the wind for 8 years, and a lot of people who actually had passed away. I think more so from stress, not knowing what was going to happen. It's a hard way to live.
EBDI never said to me, you know, sir, you know, yeah, this is what's happening. I got no information at all. No, honestly, got nothing from them. Absolutely nothing.
We were just feeling that we were going to all be just removed. And that's when all of the anger, the distrust, the bitter taste came about. And even neighbors, you had some neighbors who wanted to move. So then you have neighbor against neighbor. They were meeting and talking about what was going to happen to this revitalization process as if we were public housing residents. And because you had a mixed area here, you had homeowners, my house was paid for, you had renters, and you had public housing individuals. So you had a mixture of people living together. You can't treat them the way you would treat people who are all public housing. And I think that caused a lot of confusion because it's like, how do you have three sets of processes for this community?
And that was just a clip from this exhibition and the series you did on Saving Middle East, hearing the voices of a displaced community, images and words from a displaced community. So let's talk about what we just heard here. I mean, these are who did we listen to here? Who's on this tape?
I believe it was Pat Tracy. I think Deacon Sawyer or Reverend Sawyer, and I'm not sure the
Gerald
other one.
And Gerald Henson.
Yeah.
Who are?
Residents of
East Baltimore, actually, yeah.
So when you hear these voices, what are they saying to you?
Well, as being an outsider.
That's why I'm looking at you.
That's what I am.
This is not your neighborhood, so it's.
The more I listened, the more I realized that different truths were being understood. Different things were being heard by the residents. So they, meaning EBDI, may have had a system of informing residents, but the residents weren't understanding that system. They were getting different things being told to them, or they didn't understand what was going on. So I just didn't feel like anyone really knew what was going to happen the very next day. And that's really unsettling when it deals with you having to leave your home or not. So there was a lot of confusion. That's the very first thing that I realized after sitting down and talking with people.
This began, what, in 2005, right?
Well, it actually started in 2001.
Okay.
Of its initial beginning when they really started the process. But again, it was a long back and forth. And again, the community had to, once they found out, leaders like Ms. Lisa Williams, along with the board before I arrived to, they had said that they wanted to take in charge of the situation because they felt like this is an unfair situation because, again, there was misinformation was not given. The information was given wasn't given where you could understand it. When you follow, well, who's in charge? Who's taking the initiative? How do people understand what they need to do to control the situation? It was just out of control. It really was.
And, I mean, this has been going on a long time.
A long time.
And a lot of people who kind of moved out.
Yes.
And not be able to come back.
Right. And see, the understanding they're saying that they can come back, but there is so much red tape in order to get back into the community. The understanding we have received was that moving out, in order to be able to do the area, they had to move us out of the area and then we could come back. That didn't make sense to me. That's certainly to the community board and the community themselves because they felt like, because they didn't understand a lot of the decisions that were being made for them, they felt like they had no voice in the decision at all.
So, I mean, as an outsider observing this, someone who wasn't involved in the struggle at all, I was wondering what these voices told you, other than there are different sides of the story. I mean, what did they say to you? What do you think they're going to be saying to other people who hear them in this project you created?
Well, I feel like listening to the stories uncovered a lot of things that you wouldn't necessarily think about when you hear about a development project coming in and making an area better or cleaner. You don't really think about how communities can dissolve or histories and families' memories can dissolve once people are asked to leave. And that doesn't even mean just like memories of barbecues in your backyard, but it might mean relationships that you have with your neighbors that you depend on. And how that can affect your then physical life. Because I heard a lot of stories of individuals who had left and then didn't have Jack next door to come over and help cook him dinner. These are things that I uncovered by listening that I never really thought of with just the, you know, beyond the moving of a home and a family, but also kind of losing a social structure and a community structure.
I think we should play, now that you raise that, there's a clip here that kind of relates to that. I think it actually is the second clip. I think this is where I heard this, but we'll find out in a minute, about what people who live in the East Baltimore community of Middle East are talking about problems that demolition created. And let's listen to this clip. This is all from, by the way, the project Middle East Baltimore Stories, Images and Words from a Displaced Community. Is a book release event, book and CD event, taking place May 30th, which is Saturday, 2 to 6 p.m. at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum downtown. And this is a project of the Save Middle East Action Committee, SMEAC, Art on Purpose. It was all funded by the N.E.E. Casey Foundation. So listen to this other piece from this documentary series.
In 2004, really, I noticed that I was having problems breathing, walking up the steps. I couldn't walk up the street without stopping. It just got worse. And I finally went to see about it. And that's when I was diagnosed with interstitial lung disease. And I asked what it's from. And they told me it was from the environment. Well, during that time, there's a lot of demolition going on around here. I'm off the oxygen, thank you, that I used to be on. I had to carry a tank around with me. I'm elevated to the fact that I only use oxygen at night when I sleep. And I don't know if I'll ever get off of that. And there were no safe practices. There weren't water being washed down every time you destroyed a building. The runoff was just running down the street. So you had dust, you had rust, you had rodent problems increased more.
And I didn't have a problem until they brought all these big trucks around here and started tearing down everything. Then rats started coming up.
We had rats. We were living with some rats. So we could not leave anything exposed. We had to put away everything at night, which was a real trying time. The rats had bite out all the electrical work in the stove. The rats will always come because of these vacant buildings.
They were tearing down houses all around us and they didn't give us warnings. We would have our windows open and you come out of the bathroom and your house would be full of dust because they're tearing the house down next door. They didn't even give you enough decency and respect to actually say, okay, we're going to be doing demolition in your block tomorrow. Please close your windows.
I mean, those were pretty horrendous kind of stories we're hearing about people's lives there. And I just, you know, and I'm not sitting here thinking that Johns Hopkins Hospital is like an evil institution, I mean, and any of that. But there was clearly a kind of lack of communication and going on here. But I wonder what, if you could describe for me, Donald. You still live there, right?
I still live in the area, yes.
What these women were talking about, especially mostly women in this piece, I think, were talking about, in terms of what it was like living in the midst of all that demolition.
It was just definitely very emotional and physically draining. The sadness of and even listening to, actually the voice you heard was the former president and the former vice president of the organization, and they're still present even now. But the sadness of it is that we had to fight for safe demolition at that point because they were, like, as they were saying as they were speaking, that they were thinking, they were just talking about how sad that was and what it did to them. The health began to fail on so many levels. So we had to fight that they would, we had to stop them for tearing down buildings any longer and without going through a process of debris, watering the debris as you're tearing them. I mean, they were just tearing down blocks and just leaving them open and everything. So people were going through a lot of medical, became more medical, conditions got worse.
And you grew up there?
I grew up there, yeah.
What was it like seeing the neighborhood come down for you?
Oh, I'm trying not to even get emotional. The thought, as Barbara, you know, Beth said very clearly, you did relationships that were built. they were people just cared about everybody, If, you know, if they saw an older man walking down the street, one story in particular that was dear to my heart is that lady was 75 years old who used to clean the community every morning faithfully. And that was one of the instances, but I was able to call myself doing it for her so that she would not do it in the morning because somebody told that this young guy is helping you out. But I did it because I was so honored that she was doing it and the fact that I could incorporate myself in that. And so I felt like the community was just love. It was less love in the community on so many levels. There's Beth began to talk about the fact that you knew who, everybody knew everybody. And so if I needed something or I needed to go somewhere, somebody would just take you. It was just a community of love and compassion.
When I listen to this, it made me interesting one day to just have a conversation post-mortem in some ways with the folks at Hopkins on what might be done differently in the future for Middle East, but also how we might think differently about how to deal with large institutions and communities and how things can work the right way. Go ahead.
I just think that, you know, one thing that was a lack of communication was definitely one of the things, and we felt John Hopkins should have played a major role than they did, even for the fact that they knew that lead and asbestos was in these buildings because they were old buildings. And the project, as they say, had nothing to do with them directly, but most of the things that are happening are happening towards the betterment of Hopkins and surrounding the hospital. So, I just think the communication was a failure.
And I think that a lot of people that I talked to were not opposed to change.
No. Not
and I and they want their community to be bettered. Mm. I think what was upsetting to most people is that they felt like they were not included in the process of change, or they weren't asked about how would they like to see their community changed or bettered, and they felt completely isolated from that process. And so I think that, you know, listening to these stories, maybe there would be some kind of chance of thinking about how this kind of process could be different. How could you involve the residents? How could you communicate with them more clearly or come to an understanding of, you know, this is going to happen. What would you like to see happen? How would you like to see it happen?
It's interesting. I'd like to follow up more maybe another day about the story that we heard from Cleveland, Ohio, where a hospital similar to Hopkins in Cleveland did a similar thing, but they ended up, after a lot of confrontation, other ways, doing things very differently, where they actually helped the community create businesses that would supply that hospital with what they needed rather than going outside the community, creating a new way of life. We're going to do a whole show on that, I think, and maybe kind of talk about that with our residents here. I think there may be lessons we can learn about how to make things work better. Let me play another clip because I think it feeds right into what you were just talking about, Donald Gresham, on the Middle East community. And this is a piece that describes how residents kind of muse about the role of Hopkins played in their neighborhood. And this is number four.
You got three parking lots being built with John Hopkins. Then you got the big biotech, a little park for them to sit and eat their lunch in, but no place for me to move.
It's hard when you see what looks like wealth and opulence right here. And for years and years and years and years, there's been decay right next door. So some people think, well, was this intentional? Were you allowing this to get to this level so then you could take over our land? Why didn't you do something sooner since you had the resources?
So the community's not doing anything. The city's not doing anything. And then you got Hopkins buying their properties and then not doing anything with those properties. You know, so you got everybody that, to me, I say is responsible for the devastation and the blighting of these communities.
Most people say it's by design that they leave all these houses boarded up so that it brings down the property value. So when a developer decides to come in, then they can get the houses dirt cheap.
We have high hopes that some good will come from all that's happening here. I do grant the fact that it had to happen. The community had become so deteriorated. Not by accident, but by design. that there was no choice except to tear down whole blocks of buildings that had been so deteriorated that they couldn't be restored. But they could have been had something started 20 years before, which brings up the whole issue of, you know, the priority of the city to put its money into the inner harbor and into tourism, while the schools and housing stock in the community had fallen apart. Buildings were acquired by Hopkins and by other developers, slum landlords from outside the community, with the intention of letting them deteriorate until they could be acquired and the residents moved away. And the drug activity was by design, too. They gave away free samples on the street to unemployed black men to create a market. Now, if that's not wicked, I don't know what is.
You've been listening to this whole course this hour when you hear these clips. These are clips that come out of a project created by Art on Purpose, which is a project in Baltimore that marries social justice and the world of art. Working with communities throughout the city. They spent the past year taking photographs and compiling interviews. You're hearing the interviews now. They've been made into a book entitled Middle East Baltimore Stories, Images and Words from a Displaced Community. And you can see these photographs and hear more of this audio at the book launch this Saturday at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum from 2 to 6 p.m. Just come on down. It's free. Just walk in the door and be part of it. The project was a partnership of Art on Purpose and the Save Middle East Action Committee, funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Elizabeth Barbush is their program director at Art on Purpose and who compiled and edited these interviews. Donald Gresham is with us as well. He's president of the Save Middle East Action Committee. The lines open up 410-319-8888. and 410-319-8888. So when we heard these kind of musings, as we call them, of people talking about, you know, the history of this, what they saw happen in this community, I wondered what you think this story teaches the rest of us. I mean, what do you hope you get from this, Elizabeth, and what do you think that this teaches the rest of the community in the city of Baltimore? What do you want to come out of this? What do you want us to know about this? What is it supposed to be telling us?
Well, I said, from my point of view, just look at it and see how it affects people. It's no longer about buildings and developers. It's about a community. And one of the things we want to say, when you take the community out of the equation, it causes folks to now mistrust you, because the reality of it is you're not even considering them as people. I oftentimes say they view the community as an inconvenience, rather than support. One thing you said, and Mark, that was interesting to me, if they could have took some of the finances and allowed the people in the community, they have 80 acres of land, and I have yet to see them be able to say to the community, what would you like to happen? How can we make you part of the process? That is not happening. There has never been a dialogue. There has never been a communication. So what we like to see is when you start with a project, especially of this magnitude, you definitely need to communicate with the community that is affected by it.
I mean, one of the things, again, this Cleveland lesson that I'm just beginning to study and learned about at a meeting I was at the other week, is that is people helping the establishment, the city helping the establishment of cooperative industries in that community that the community ran, where literally they would do things from the cooking to laundry to all kinds of things a hospital needed, that built and created right there rather than going out of the city and out of the state to buy them. They buy them right here, and it puts people to work in the community as well as keeping the hospital institution going. I mean, so there are creative, interesting ways to think about how we resolve issues that maybe we're not talking about, mm-hmm. you know, and figuring out a different way and not always in the same market-driven model yeah. that builds everything that
we
do.
With my work at Art on Purpose, I've learned that there just isn't one way of doing things, especially if you want to do it right. And when you're going into any new community, you really have to find out what works for that space, what works for that group of people. And I think that is one big lesson that I think should be learned from this, is listening to these individual stories. Any organization that wants to come into a community and accomplish something, whether it's a development or a new business, They really have to ask the people that live there and get their feedback and opinions about how this could work for this community instead of this is going to happen and work for this community.
Right. I mean, often we see these things, no matter what the institution, not just happens anywhere else. I mean, it's that city government planning agencies often, and I think that may be changing because the planning agency and commission in Baltimore is really starting to have a different way of doing things, which is really good because of the leadership there now. But the idea that people do these things, these charrettes with these designs, but they come in with a charrette and say, this is what we're going to do. What's your feedback? As opposed to maybe saying, let's talk together about this idea we have and how your community can feed into it and how we build this together. They're very different models of how to approach this. We're going to open the phones here, but you want to say something?
Yeah, I just want to say, Mark, that one thing we did the charrettes, and the information that we gave them, they misplaced it. After we did all the work and got everything organized, and they asked us, that's the question they did. They had us to do that, and we showed where we wanted trees at, where we wanted businesses at, and how people wanted the community to look. But at the end of the day, they came with a pre-idea already. So they didn't even, it wasn't the interest of the community and what they thought.
Let's open the phones here as we look at the Middle East community and the project Art on Purpose created called Middle East Baltimore Stories, Images and Words from a Displaced Community that will be opening at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. And this Saturday from 2 to 6, there's a launch party. We can see more of these photographs and hear more of this audio that we're playing. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Ben, you're on the air.
Yes, my name is Ben. And my question was, I've been living in East Baltimore for 59 years. And the small businesses that were in the area at the time that they were doing all this tearing down, they never called a meeting for the businesses to come in to let them know that if you were making a living off the people in the community, that when we move these people out, you will no longer be able to support your family because you won't have any business coming in from the community.
What was your business? Did you have a business there?
Yes. I have a body shop there. It didn't affect me too much, but all the other stores and the shop owners that I knew, most of them had to fold up and leave.
And were a lot of these businesses owned by African Americans who lived in the community or lived around the community?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, I was probably one of the original board members. We were called MECO back in the 80s, and we did a 50-year plan. And what they're doing now, we did a 50-year plan developing that whole area, just what they're doing now. We did the study over at Morgan, and we put together a 50-year plan.
See, this is that's why, as hard as it's been for the Middle East community to go through this, maybe there's an opportunity for us to kind of help the city figure out a different way to do things.
Yes.
So this doesn't happen again, and maybe even save what's left of the community that can work together with this institution to create something that fits everybody. You know, I mean, we have to salvage something from this. You know, Ben, you lead me into a piece I'd like to play, and I thank you so much for being part of this show. Before we go to our next caller, Tim, hold on. I want to get your thoughts but I want to play this piece because it has to do with the past. It has to do with residents sharing their memories of the neighborhood they've lost. This is clip number 3.
Charlotte Johnson, 57 years old, been in the East Side all my life, from down to the riots when Martin Luther King got shot, down to John F. Kennedy and coming past Washington Street back in the early 60s. I've been through the East Side where we couldn't go in the front door of the store. We had to go in the side. You know, so there's been a lot of changes. In 1953, when my parents and I moved in that home, we were the second black families in that block for years. So now I slowly sat growing up and watched the white folks move out slowly but surely. But they were nice people. We made that home. That was our neighborhood. People have come and gone, and we still stayed there. We've struggled, but we still stood.
My name is Helen Rose, and I live at 1708 East Chase Street. I've been living here for like 19 years. Oh, the neighborhood is so nice when you can sit outside in the summertime and the flowers, George flowers cross the street, mine's over here. Just sit out there and enjoy the spiritual. The kids sitting there eating their frozen cups and everything. Girls walking around pushing their babies, everybody laughing and smiling. It can be beautiful around here when it wants to.
When I first moved around here, it was beautiful. We even actually had a peach tree in our backyard, which my mother grew from a peach tree seed. It was a mixed community,
it slowly but surely became predominantly a black community, which was still a good community. But then the drugs came, and then the homeowners moved out, and it became more renters. And then the community just started to go down.
I think that speaks so beautifully in some ways to the power of African-American culture in the communities that were in this city that held together. And, you know, it shouldn't have just to be a memory.
Yeah.
It needs to be kind of the root of the future, right, as opposed to the stories of what has been and let's lament it.
Definitely, Mark.
Let me go back to the phone, and we'll come back to our guests as we talk to Donald Grisham and Elizabeth Barbush. 410-319-8888. Tim in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Thank y'all very much for talking about this. This is so important to me. I moved in Baltimore in 2001, and I worked with the families on the Broadway Homes Project. And what I saw when I got here was families of Baltimore with the Baltimore culture, the Baltimore everything, who knew about the stone brick fronts and having to clean them. I saw them disappear, and I see them more and more disappearing each and every day, to the point that I've gotten so upset that I started my own community development corporation, and we do what they call backwards community development. We work with the community first and then start building the homes, because a home is not a home if you don't have a family in it. And we see that on the east side each and every day. I go to Israel Church, and I'm looking at boarded up houses after boarded up houses. And my question to the guests as much as to the city is, when are you going to stop and sit down and talk to the community about developing what they need in order to stay in the community before Baltimore becomes a place of foreigners and immigrants from other lands and other cities and other states, and there's no such thing as a real Baltimorean left?
Well, I haven't been a born-bred Baltimorean just like Donald Grisham. I mean, I also do welcome all the immigrants and all the other people coming in the city. I think it makes the city vibrant, but I do hear what you're saying, Donald.
I just think the history is so important to Baltimore. And the interesting part about it, as the man said very clearly, is one thing that has been missing is not engaging a conversation with the community that's being affected by our process. When you leave them out, you're going to have that continuation of feeling like, well, what are you doing? You kind of move me out so you can take over. And then my history, which I'm part of, is gone. That's the question. I hear him. I agree with him. In certain areas, I'm not saying, you know, I'm all right for having a diverse group of people, but history is important.
History is important. And that's part of what you're preserving here with this project.
Yes.
Is that history. And hopefully it's something for the future. Let's go back to the phones now. I'm going to play, hopefully I've got time to play one or two more clips from this incredible project put together by Art on Purpose. Elizabeth Barbush is with us, who's program director, put this together. Middle East Baltimore Stories, Images and Words from a Displaced Community. And Donald Grisham, who is president of the Save Middle East Action Committee, the community we're talking about. 410-319-8888. Robert, you're on the air.
I like to just say that I grew up in East Baltimore, and I always loved East Baltimore.
You there, Robert?
It's just it's just how it is now. It's just not the same. And, you know, at one time I was trying to find a house down there. You couldn't find a house because everything was boarded up, or Hopkins had bought everything. So you couldn't, if you were a low income like myself, you couldn't buy anything. And, you know, it's nowhere like I grew up there. I grew up around there. I can't take my grandkids around there and say, this is where I used to run at. The house that we used to have is gone. Both houses. I grew up on Bond Street, and I grew up on Caroline Street. But I still have that East Baltimore pride. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Peter. And I hear the emotion in your voice. I mean, it means a lot to people. But East Baltimore was...
It's home.
It was home there, and it was in the old days. It was back in the day in the '50s, and the early '60s. It was the smaller of the two major black communities in Baltimore, the West Side and East Side.
Under that, Mark, I think one of the things it was such a family way of life. Everybody kind of just knew everybody, and put, you know, you were able to feel like wherever you were, whatever you were going,
yes,
through, you had somebody there that understood or was willing to listen.
I mean, I was a little boy, and I was actually in the Boy Scout troop at the Faith Baptist Church on Ashland Avenue,
okay,
in 1957, And I remember I remember it well. I mean, the kind of community it was, you know. And I think that some of that, in some levels, has to be preserved and has to be kind of figured out a way we can resurrect it as a 21st century community.
Yes.
You know, let's go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Jeff in Bel Air, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Hello. It's Jeff from Bel Air, Maryland.
Welcome.
And my question is to the Baltimore City residents out of these communities. You know, you were given a chance to purchase these homes even after they decayed, yet they didn't. So why wasn't the homes purchased by the residents? And two, big business has purchased them. And so if the residents didn't want to buy them and big business purchased them, why is it such a problem for the residents? I mean, if they didn't want them, big business purchased them, why do they have a problem?
Can I respond to that? I totally disagree with that, because first of all, most of the community was a low income community. People who worked for GM and for big corporations like the old Bethlehem Steel. Most of those people were mostly seniors at that point, and most of the people in the community was not able to buy those properties, because first of all, most of the properties was bought by Hopkins and set dormant and was not allowed to buy them.
You could not buy the properties.
We couldn't buy them. No, we couldn't buy them. The developers who wanted to support the community, and we spoke with them. They said that when they would try to get blocks, say, well, I'd like to take this block and make it for affordable housing, they said they couldn't get to it because nobody could, you know, they couldn't find out who owned them, or if they found out who owned them, they couldn't get them.
So, Jeff, before we go to our next caller, who's Lois, do you have another thought you want to throw in there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay, yes. And the other statement, you know, I wanted to make was because the city was not going to the website. It looked like the city had put a program for the residents to purchase homes, and yet, you know, these programs aren't being used, you know. So I hear this a lot from people that I work with, you know, who live in Baltimore. They complain a lot, but I just don't see them making any taking any action, you know, to make things better for themselves or their community, you know. So thank you very much. I love WEAA, and keep up the good work.
Jeff, thanks for your call.
Again, I whatever was on the website, I do understand one thing, that John Hopkins originally land banked those homes, left them, and again went through the back door with the city and sold them back to the city. Now, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I understand, we were not able to, and I'm standing on that. You know.
Well, we can look into that more when we have a conversation in the air with all the folks in the room, all the stakeholders. 410-319-8888. Lois from Havity Grace, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment in a general way about the sadness I feel about the homogenization of American culture overall. It's not just the East Baltimore section. It's, you know, you used to be able to go to a truck stop in Pocatello, Idaho, and it had a local flavor, and you could soak it up. And the historic buildings are disappearing. And I think it's just a disregard for the value of the culture. And the other comment I wanted to make was that when I was a student at Temple University in Philadelphia, Temple's campus that I attended was in what you can only call ghetto. Mm-hmm. And I made friends with the residents there and listened to their stories. And what I was hearing was that they wanted to work. They wanted so much to work. And all around there were the boarded up buildings and the same situation that you were just talking about. And I talked to my professors about, you know, maybe we could get grants. Maybe we could set up local businesses. And I got a lot of information, and then I got told, you know, you can't get insurance in places like this. You can't guarantee safety in places like this. This is a problem that has a lot of factors that bear on it, and I think we need to be thinking about all of those.
Lois, I think you raise a really, really important point.
Definitely.
Have you had thoughts about that? I mean, this is what we were talking about earlier, about there's got to be exploring different ways for cities and major institutions dealing with communities to address these problems.
I believe if you want the community to be a part of it, a part of the process, and the caller was true, that the fact that it's everywhere, and the problem is, we're just talking about Middle East, but I'm sure we could talk about the various areas around us, and Colombia is going through the same thing right now. The interesting part about it is that when is somebody...
Colombia, Maryland.
Right. Yeah, they're going through the same thing. And one thing that is interesting, that it's a problem, is that nobody wants to talk to the affected people in the process. Like, they don't understand what is going on, and that they could not make good decisions to make the community whole. That's a problem.
What struck me about the caller was that she felt motivated to talk to her professors after she actually sat and listened to the residents. And
that's
so
right.
The right. idea of collecting the stories and not just it being me sitting in people's homes and listening, but being able to create these audio pieces, put it into a book that then Save Middle East Action Committee can get out and have other people who may actually be able to make changes or be motivated to then make changes. After listening to it, that's really the goal of putting this kind of project together, is to have a lot of people like Lois out there listening and then feeling motivated to, you know, to realize what really is going on and try to put that information into people that can actually make changes' hands.
Absolutely.
A very quick thought. James in Baltimore, you're on the air.
I was listening to the last caller, and my thing was, I was thinking about what half of these houses... Yes, this is James.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Jimmy, turn on your radio. So
yeah, I was thinking about these houses was brought by the University Hospital.
The houses were bought by the hospital. And we've had this show on before many times over the years. And we want to actually bring Hopkins back, but maybe for a different kind of conversation about what to do as we look forward in the future. Let's try to get one more quick caller in. Can we do that? Very fast. Amanda, you're on the air, but just 30 seconds.
Yes. Thank you so much for doing this show. I was born and raised in East Baltimore. And one thing I do realize, I'm in my mid-30s now. I want to respond to what Jeff from Bel Air said. So many of us have chosen to leave East Baltimore, and we just didn't buy the houses. And now, unfortunately, we're in a situation where Hopkins has bought everything up, and we see people of other colors buying the property, and now we're upset about it. It would be good if we could come back, if we could just find a way to do it. Thank you.
Well, we'll continue this, and I want to thank all of you for calling in. I thank Elizabeth Barbers for the project she helped create with the Art on Purpose, Middle East Baltimore Stories, Images and Words from a Displaced Community. This project was a partnership with Art on Purpose and the Save Middle East Action Committee. Donald Gresham's with us. He's president of Save Middle East Action Committee. And it was funded by the N.E. Casey Foundation. Join us at the launch this Saturday afternoon from 2 to 6 p.m. at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, where you can see these photographs, hear more, and also get the book and see this exhibit that'll be there at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, Middle East Baltimore Stories, Images and Words from a Displaced Community. Thank you both for being with us. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much. You.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Jackson Hubolt. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.